This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orange County is one of the largest school districts in Florida, and the school board election is generating a lot of attention in the run-up to the August 28th election. Candidates for the district's sixth seat and school board chair talked about some of the issues facing the board at a forum at Baldwin Park Elementary School last Tuesday. You're going to hear part of that forum. Running for chair are the Orange County Mayor Teresa Jacobs, school board member Nancy Robinson, OCPS Administrator Matthew Fitzpatrick and teacher Robert Prater. Running for the district's sixth seat are Karen Castor-Dental, Patricia Fox and Charlene Roberts-Narado. Candidates were asked what they think the school district has done well to retain teachers and what can be improved. Robert Prater began the discussion.
You know, we're $10,000 behind the national average for teacher pay. You know, I'm a nice guy, but you know, we are the lowest paid profession with a 4-year degree, and then on top of it, to be $10,000 below the national average. You know, I know sitting up here complaining about money is probably not going to win me votes, but the fact of the matter is, we need teachers in these classrooms, and we need to pay them. We need to maintain their benefits, and this all takes money. We are hoping that you will pass the $1 million that will be on the ballot August 28th. If not, we're going to be in bigger trouble. So we need your help and as much as you need teachers in those classrooms. We are in a very competitive society where Seminole County, Lake County, Osceola County are fighting for those teachers coming out of UCF. For the most part, that's where the teaching pool is coming from. And there's only about 1,000 of them coming out of there per year. So we need to do a better job in recruiting and offering better packages for them, because they're coming out of there with student loans. Recruiting teachers is not a problem. It's keeping them. All right. So the national average needs to improve.
Okay, so Teresa Jacobs, same question. Teacher retention. What has the school district done well to retain teachers and staff, and what needs to change?
Well, I think Mr. Prater nailed it, that I cannot identify anything in the last 10 years that I can see that has been done well to retain teachers. And I would attribute that as more to what we've seen coming out of the state. And I want to thank you, Representative Castor-Dental, for the effort that you've made. I don't know why we can't make more progress at the state level. That's where I think we need to galvanize this whole community, because we are going to have a crisis at some point. We are looking at the lowest unemployment rates that we've seen in a very long time. I know too many kids. They were kids with my kids. My kids went to Orange County Public Schools. All four of them graduated, got a great education. But too many of their friends that went into teaching did not make it more than 2 years. And it's the same story all over again. And it's not just the pay. The pay does need to be better, but it's more than the pay. Because teachers that I know that teach, they are not doing it for the money. They are doing it for the passion. And I so respect that, but you shouldn't have to sacrifice your whole family's quality of living in order to do something that used to be revered. And that is a very, very high calling, and that's teaching. What is more important to our community than law enforcement? Well, I would say law enforcement, number one, in terms of keeping a society safe. Second is having an educated population. So we've got to put more respect and more appreciation to our teachers, and that's a cultural change that needs to happen from the top down and the bottom up.
All right, Matthew Fitzpatrick, what has the school district done well to retain teachers and staff, and what do you think needs to change?
Excellent question. What we've done well, if you look at the teachers that are staying, those are the ones that are trapped mid-year in their career, okay? They can't quit and go to something else, and they might as well hang on for their pension, okay? Those are the ones that are staying. The ones that are at the end, they're going into early retirement as soon as they can, okay? The ones at the beginning, they get into it, and it's like, all right, I can find something else. What really tells you we have a problem, this is what I saw as an assistant principal when a principal tells me, he told his own kids, you can go into anything you want except for education. Now, when someone has given their life to education, then turns and says, listen, don't go into education, it's a mess. That tells me that we have some big problems to address. And if you look at the college, the schools of education at the colleges and universities, they're down 50% of students going into education. So not only are the baby boomers retiring, but we don't have people coming in. The only ones that are staying, which we're retaining, are the ones that have to stay. So we need to change something in terms of how we evaluate our teachers, which is demoralizing, it's micromanaging, it's nitpicking. We have to change the way we evaluate them. We also have to change letting a teacher teach. They came into this profession for passion. Let them express that.
If you could pass the microphone down to Charlene at the end. Same question, teacher retention. What has the school district done well to retain teachers and staff, and what needs to change?
Well, I think it's been pretty clear that we don't think they've done much to retain the teachers. I feel like when I talk to teachers that what they want is autonomy in their classroom. They want to be able to be creative, and they want to be able to teach what their subject is. And they're being told to do this and do that. They have 64 things they have to do in their classroom. Ugh. Then when they're reviewed on just a couple. I worked in my professional career was in human resources, and I maintained and processed evaluations for years. This is not how you do that. I won't answer the follow-up. You need to keep someone happy in their position. You need to take advantage of their strengths. And our teachers are creative, and they want to teach, and they want to be here and do that. And we have not done anything to keep them. We have not paid them appropriately. We have not rewarded them appropriately. We need to do something. And we clearly are not doing that right now. So in my opinion, no, we have not done anything to retain our teachers. We need to do more to bring them and to keep them happy and to help them be the best that they can be, which in turn makes our kids' experience and our kids' education the best that it can be. If we don't value our teachers, why should our kids value it?
So, Patricia, teacher retention, what has the school district done well to retain teachers and staff, and what needs to change?
Well, I'm an early retiree, so I'm a prime example of what was not done well for me. It was very difficult to teach when all of a sudden what you were teaching was not the subject matter that you were supposed to be teaching. When all of a sudden what you were being evaluated on was, are you walking north, south, east, or west? It didn't matter the lesson plan that I prepared in order to teach, because I knew how my students needed to learn, and I did a lot of hands-on teaching. When all of a sudden what became very important was, where was the date on the board of my classroom? Because if I didn't put it on a particular place, that the children were going to be so confused that they were not going to be able to learn. I know, ridiculous, but that is how we were evaluated. And then on top of that, when Marzano came on, the administrators were told that they cannot have outstanding teachers. So it didn't matter if I was the new Einstein, I was not going to get the grade that I needed to get for myself. So I'm a prime example of what OCPS has done well to retain good teachers.
All right, Karen Castadental, what has the school district done well to retain teachers and staff, and what needs to change?
Thank you. Well, a lot of the problems I've heard so far up here stem from Tallahassee. I got to spend a couple years up there and see where the disrespect starts. So when we talk about what has Orange County done to retain teachers, a lot of the problems start with Tallahassee and the funding that they give Orange County Public Schools to pay their teachers. I fought for more funding, and they just kept shifting it to vouchers and charter schools. There is a lot of disrespect for teachers across the board, throughout the state, even across the country, I might say. But we feel it here in Orange County, and I can tell the difference between what are the county level issues and what are the state level issues. And the county seems like they micromanage. They, instead of a dialogue with teachers, they are a top-down management with a heavy hand kind of operation. So as a school board member, I would hope to involve more teachers and more parents in those decisions. Once teachers feel like they're heard, you will see a change in whether they feel valued, if they feel like they're making a difference. I mean, I didn't become a teacher to become rich. You know, I knew that going in. But I also expected to be effective. And some of the things that are going on right now with Orange County Public Schools prevent that.
Okay, last but not least, Nancy Robinson. What has the school district done well to retain teachers and staff, and what do you think needs to change?
Well, I'll throw out the elephant in the room. I'm the only school board member that's currently serving sitting up here. And I realize that, and I think it's very interesting that I'm sitting in the middle. And I want y'all to know there's been four candidate forums, and I've attended all four of them. I'm not afraid to answer the tough questions. That's why I'm here. And that's what I always do. I answer your emails and your phone calls, and I fight for everybody, including the teachers. That's why I have the endorsement of the Classroom Teachers Association over my two educators sitting on the stage with me. So with all that being said, it is a large problem. Teacher retention is a large problem. It's a national problem. It's just not an Orange County Public School problem. And the problem with it is it's a complex problem. The education is being beat up left and right from everywhere, from every angle. And we are fighting as hard and as fast and as furiously as we can. We have been able to pay our teacher raises during this economy, this horrible downturn in the economy, which hit us in 2009. The recession's been incredible. Because we had the forethought, in fact, I asked my board to go with me on a $1 million special referendum to go out to the voters to help us with the, because we weren't getting funding from Tallahassee, we went out and got the voters to approve a $1 million referendum special meal, so that we would have dollars in our operating budget during this downturn of the economy. And that has sustained us during this time. We are right now in a settlement agreement with our teachers. It's out for teachers to vote for a 4% raise. I guarantee you no other district in the state of Florida is giving their teachers a 4% raise. And that is out being hopefully being ratified right now with the teachers. We work really hard. We do our part. I go and I listen to teachers at teacher summits. I sit there and listen, And that's why I got the endorsement, because I am working hard and I've been doing this, and it is a problem.
School safety was another big issue. Candidates were asked what they would do to promote school safety, beginning with Nancy Robinson.
Well, the beauty in Orange County is we've already been doing a lot to promote school safety. We started right after Sandy Hook back in 2013. The school board asked the superintendent to please bring in an outside security threats assessment firm, and they came in and they analyzed and assessed all 200 of our facilities, and they gave us a long list of things that we needed to do better. And we have slowly been able to implement that, and that's because we have the half-cent sales tax that the voters have approved for us that go directly to building our facilities. And we've been able to implement the things that they suggested, which are on our new facilities since that time. We have a single point of entry. We have a video intercom system. We have increased campus security with fencing and video surveillance. We got our own police department of about 15 police officers that work as liaisons with the different nine different municipalities within Orange County that serve our schools with our school resource officers. So we are already doing a lot here. Doesn't mean there's not more to be done. There's always more to be done. And we asked that same group that gave us the assessment back then to come back, and they did that this summer. And in fact, it's humorous. I'm missing an executive session tonight of my board to be here with you, and they're getting an update on what this is going to happen, so I'm going to get a private update later. But what we also did in response to Parkland, the legislator actually did give us some money. They gave us, in part of the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas Act, they gave us specifically dollars for mental health services. We get $4.7 million that comes right here to Orange County Public Schools. That's going to enable us to hire 51 mental health professionals and implement new programs. So we're doing things, and there's always more to be done, but we're working hard.
Thank you, Nancy. If you could pass the microphone to your left, and Karen Cassidental, I'm going to ask you the same question. If elected, what will you do to promote school safety?
First of all, I have to acknowledge that OCPS is
ahead of the game when you compare other counties in the state. Because we have that additional funding for our schools, we have been able to keep up with rebuilding and renovating schools so that they have all those features that Nancy mentioned. And I know in Hillsborough, they're not nearly as fortunate as we are, but there are a lot of things we can continue to do. In the classroom, as a teacher, I was always thinking, you know, I've had those lockdown drills where I have to force 24 fourth graders into a little bathroom and turn the lights off and be very quiet for however long. And that is a very stressful kind of drill to do, and then try to pretend like, oh, nothing's going to happen. So I would like to see more emergency preparation protocols for employees when the kids are not around. We do a lot of times some drills when we're in the classroom. But what happens if we're in the cafeteria? I can tell you that the teachers and the school employees don't have a plan. So each school is unique, but I think we need to have those practice runs or some brainstorming at each school site. Something that we need to really talk about is not just how do we fortify our buildings and have all these features, because we've seen that those don't always stop these people with these military assault weapons. And I think we need to work together and support a ban on military style weapons.
Okay, Patricia Fox. So if elected to school board, what will you do to promote school safety?
Well, I'd like to first thank OCPS because of all the, and mostly the taxpayers for being able to have the funding for the new buildings. Edgewater High School was an open campus, and it left us wide open, and we did have a very difficult time when one day we had the SWAT team come in, and we were on a complete lockdown for 4 hours. That was a scary moment because we had to keep the children from freaking out, so to speak. And, you know, that was our job. However, in case of something happening, we were supposed to run out of our buildings, down and be in the wide open. Now we're all closed in, one point of entry. However, the one thing that we do need a lot more of, and I'm thankful that the legislature has given us somewhat some money for mental health, but mental health has to be more of a wraparound service for our students. What I mean by that is our students, when they're in school, if they have a problem, the very first line of defense is the counselors. The counselors know what's going on, serve as a support system for the students while they're on campus, and are able to get any extra help that is needed for not only the student, but the families themselves. So that's what I mean by wraparound services.
Charlene Roberts-Norado. So if elected, what will you do to promote school safety?
Well, first of all, I want to say that as a parent, I was very happy to see our schools employ these measures that they have, the single point entry, the fences, the gates. It's great. I'm from Miami-Dade County, and some of the schools down there actually look like prisons. So I'm pleased that ours have a better feel to them. I will say, however, that most of our schools need to be revamped. Edgewater is a great example. When I go to get buzzed in at Edgewater, there is a buzzer, and you buzz it, and then you're in a hallway that is wide open to the rest of the school. The office is behind another locked door. So in my opinion, although that is somewhat safer, because you do have to get buzzed in, it's not really that safe, because it's wide open. There are schools that have portables that are feet from a busy highway, where anyone going by could shoot at that. There are places that are just not as safe as they could be. So I think that we would need to go school by school and identify our areas where we have weaknesses. I also feel that mental health is a huge factor. We need to have counselors who are actually dedicated counselors, not scheduling people.
Thank you, Charlene. If you could pass the microphone down to Robert Prater. Robert, if elected, what will you do to promote school safety?
Well, I really didn't get to get into my resume. One of the, I was a classroom teacher, and now I'm a dean. So I do conduct the emergency drills every month, and we do various ones. And when we do them, we, you know, I really make them like act like they're, you know, they're real. So I'll do, and like, so when the kids hear me do that, they react, because we want them, if it's a fire drill, we want them out of the building as quickly as possible. If we need them to lock down, I don't do that. We say it very calmly. It depends on the situation, but you know, obviously the Parkland thing is tragic. Another one happened in Texas. I, as you can see, I'm trying to avoid saying shootings, because it, you know, when you say that, people died. And what's really sad is, we're forgetting. We can go back to Columbine, the 1990s. This has been going on far, far too long. Now, we are fortunate here in Orange County that we have this half-cent sales tax. But we need to look at our perimeters, make sure our fencing is properly. It's more than guns. We got to make sure people aren't getting on our properties. We got to make sure that we have speed bumps, that people aren't driving like crazy people on our properties. And I see parents shaking their heads like, yeah, I see it all. I see it every day.
Okay, so Mayor Jacobs, if elected to school board chair, what will you do to promote school safety?
Thank you. Let me start by what I've already done. Probably most people don't realize that the role of Orange County Mayor isn't just the chairman of the board. The mayor is the CEO of the organization, but the mayor is also the official emergency management director for all of Orange County. So to put in perspective, I came in January of 2011. December of 2012, we had the Sandy Hook shootings. And some argued at the time that I was out of my lane, but what I immediately did was I called the superintendent and asked her if she would be receptive to us putting a deputy in every single elementary school. I then called the sheriff and asked him if he would cooperate and I would fund it. So my plan was immediately, and I mean this is within 24 hours of the school shooting, to have a deputy in every single elementary school when those children returned from the Christmas holiday so that they could feel safe and so that the school district would have time to evaluate safety measures and address this. Today we sit here with the governor and the legislature saying we need to have a deputy in every elementary school. I tried that after Sandy Hook. We did that for a short period of time, and then it dropped back. We need to have a deputy in every elementary school, not a teacher. Teachers should not be worrying about carrying guns, and children should not be worried about teachers with guns. And we should not make our schools look like prisons, and there should not be metal detectors. We are way more advanced than that.
All right, first of all, let me say that parents care more about safety than they do about student achievement, because if your child doesn't come home, we got a big problem. Okay, so I think that Orange County is on the right track in terms of putting deputies and police officers in every school, SROs. The one thing that I think that I look at from my many years in education is, you know, we do have to have strong perimeters, and we do need single points of entry. But also, you know, why isn't there some type of security person right there at the door? Every other place that where people enter a place, an institution, an airport, or Disney, wherever, you have security right there at the door, because if there's a problem, you want someone right there. But we don't do that, and I think that's something we need to look at, because if we're not going to buy doors that are bulletproof, it's not going to take long to get through the door. All right, so that's just something that, but there's another aspect of safety that I like to talk about, because I believe it's safety every day, and it's our discipline policies. If we don't have consistent discipline and meaningful consequences, safety within our schools is going to get worse. And I saw this in a video at Apopka High School where there was a multi-participant fight. At first it was two kids, and then others jumped in. Now, it used to be the school board policy that if it was a multi-participant fight, those students were expelled, because you can't have that. The police officers had to put it out with pepper spray, and it caused a lot of other problems.
And that was candidate for Orange County School Board Chair Matthew Fitzpatrick talking about school safety. That was from a candidate forum recorded at Baldwin Park Elementary School last Tuesday. You can find a link to a recording of the full panel at our website, wmfe.org/intersection. Up next, if Florida was a country, it would have the world's 17th biggest economy. Are tariffs a threat, though? Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Florida's economy is worth $1 trillion. According to the Tampa Bay Times, it's bigger than Switzerland, Saudi Arabia, Argentina, and the Netherlands. But tariffs and talk of a trade war have Florida businesses worried. For more about what tariffs mean for the Sunshine State, we're joined by Alice Ancona. She's Director of International Strategy and Policy with the Florida Chamber of Commerce based in Miami. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Matthew.
So there have been reports from some businesses that import components, say for manufacturing, that tariffs on those imports are going to put people out of work and hurt those companies' bottom line. What are you hearing from your members?
We're hearing a lot of the same concern. Many of our manufactured components here in the state of Florida include imported parts from around the world. And the recent announcements from the administration on tariffs on some of those imported components will certainly add to the costs, either making the production of these final products cost prohibitive or being unable to fulfill a contract based on escalated costs due to the tariffs that are being implemented, both from the administration on the imports or reciprocal from other countries.
Are you seeing this more with some industries than others? Like, are there some members of the Florida Chamber who are saying they're going to be more affected than others?
For the most part, it is manufacturers that we are hearing the most from, so advanced manufacturing parts, aviation, aerospace, boating, yachting. Those are the ones that are being hurt right now the most and the soonest. But we do know that there's impacts coming down the line on agricultural exports from the U.S., for example, from Florida. So there'll be other industry sectors that will be impacted from these recent actions.
And, of course, agriculture is a pretty big component of the Florida economy. But if you talk about things like aerospace and that sort of manufacturing, I mean, those are good-paying jobs. That's like the top end of the economy, right? So what is your concern, or what is the Chamber's concern about the impacts of tariffs and other implications of these kind of global shifts in trade on those particular parts of this economy?
Broadly, I think it's important to put into context what international trade means to the state of Florida. It's about a quarter of our economy. International trade and investment, either directly or indirectly, impacts our economy. You know, it's about a good quarter of our economy. A lot of our activity within the state of Florida deals with international trade, especially in the manufacturing sector. So about 37% of what Florida manufactures gets exported. And many of those exports contain imported components. So it's a pretty significant impact when it comes to across the board, you know, a lot of those manufacturing products that later get exported. Aviation and aerospace certainly is important. So is medical device. And these are products that are tied to, as you put, and correctly so, advanced manufacturing, which are high-paying jobs. There's been a lot of economic momentum that the state of Florida has benefited from. You cited earlier, you know, the Florida Chamber Foundation announced that we did hit $1 trillion, so that's about a G20 size economy. And trade has been a big part of that economic momentum, economic growth, attracting investments, generating additional economic activity. We've seen growth in manufacturing, which has led to greater exports from Florida in terms of Florida origin exports. So there is a concern that we are watching what this could mean. I think it's too soon to tell. Imports, the tariffs on imports are recently being implemented. These are things that are happening over the past couple of weeks. So it's not an immediate hit, but we are very concerned about what the long-term impact could be to manufacturing activity and our exporting potential.
So which countries does Florida do the most business with?
We have a pretty diversified economy. I think most people would be surprised who we export to and who we trade with. For the most part, we do trade with just about every region of the world. So it's not just limited to, and I think most people think that being in Florida, we are trading specifically or primarily a lot with Latin America. But a lot of our larger exporters, for example, Canada is one of our most important trading relationships. Number two in Florida origin exports, meaning products that we manufacture here in the state, Canada's second rank. Number one is Brazil. in terms and Mexico's number three, Germany's number four, and Colombia's number five. So we're pretty broad-based in terms of what we export and in terms of what we produce here. But we also receive a lot of foreign direct investment. And when I talked a little bit about earlier, a quarter of our economy is based or tied to international trade and investment. Investment is an important part of what we do as our trade portfolio. Mm-hmm. And these actions on tariffs could also jeopardize or impact our investment, foreign direct investment into the state. And these are relationships that we have that we've built over the years, and they're based on our ability to be good trading partners with the rest of the world. And investment is a way that other countries see us as a good partner. So it's not just about tariffs. It's not just about the impact on imports. It's also about our relationships with our investors that have invested heavily in the state.
How do you reassure those investors then? How do you try and make sure that they don't just say, okay, we'll go somewhere else?
Well, that's something that as a Chamber of Commerce, we can directly work on, and we are actually taking our first trade mission abroad to the UK and Ireland in December. But part of that reason is to help continue maintain those relationships. The EU was targeted for tariffs. That's an important partner and investor. A top investor actually in Florida is from the EU. The UK as well with Brexit, but we also want to maintain those relationships despite what may be happening at the administration level and what we're looking at the tariffs, with the tariffs being imposed. We want to ensure that Florida still remains visible, that we want to be a good trading partner to everyone, that we want to ensure that those investment flows continue into the state. Our number one investor, foreign direct investor, is the UK. They're a significant investor with over 600 UK-based companies here in Florida employing Floridians. You know, those are important jobs. Those are important investments. And those relationships do matter. So as a chamber, we work a lot with our consular corps to address those issues, work with them on maintaining the relationships. And now, beginning in December, we'll be leading our first trade mission to also escalate our level of engagement at the international level.
Finally, Alice and Kona, where do you see this? How do you see this trade war, if that's what it is, shaking out?
Well, I believe, and this is just, you know, I can't speak for the administration. I think many of us are hoping that this is just a short-term tool that the administration is using to renegotiate some trade deals. And I think NAFTA has been a big part of the conversation over the past year, and particularly since the presidential election. And NAFTA certainly was worthy of renegotiation. It's an over 20-year-old agreement. There's things that needed to be addressed and revised. And I think in all free trade agreements, there's certainly areas where you need to revisit, not necessarily scrap. And NAFTA being a big one and actually the biggest spotlight that led to a lot of these conversations. So I hope, and I think many of us that are in international trade hope, that this is really what it is. It's just to begin conversations on having fairer trade, on providing greater market access to U.S. companies, to international markets, to allow U.S. companies to continue to show how successful they can be in exporting. Those are things that are important for us to ensure that we're leveling the playing field for U.S. companies. And I think there's pretty good documentation that U.S. companies have not had a level playing field internationally, and those are issues that need to be addressed. A trade war is not exactly the best way to do that, but perhaps that could lead to a positive income and outcome, and we can avoid an all-out trade war and address those unfair trading practices.
Well, Alice Ancona is the Director of International Strategy and Policy with the Florida Chamber of Commerce. Alice, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Up next, Orlando singer-songwriter Luke Wagner and violinist Tanner Johnson join us in the studio for a performance. Intersection's back in a minute.
Well, it's a New Year's Day. I haven't seen you for a while.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. And here's Luke Wagner and Tanner Johnson with a track called Skin. Thank you.
talk, it ain't cheap. Well, after all the lessons I learned, I know what time now means. And you've got a little something hiding in your eyes. Are you looking for love or some other kind of surprise? Are you happier now standing on your own? Are you looking for another friend? Are you satisfied with the ways you've grown? Are you comfortable in your own skin? By the river, the sounds coming out from the Phoenix Amphitheater. And I remember your smile, and I remember your touch. And I think about them all until I think too much. And I'm hanging my hat at another door. Sometimes I wonder what all this trouble's for. Well, are you happier now standing on your own? Are you looking for another friend? Well, are you satisfied in the ways you've grown? Are you comfortable in your own skin? It's been a long time, and I wonder who you see. Is it just the ghost of someone I used to be? And I hear you laughing, and I hear you joke. Pour another drink and light another smoke. We're all headed down the same line, we're all waiting on the end. A little room, shed some skin. Leave a little room, shed some skin. Leave a little room, shed some skin.
That was a song called Skin off our upcoming album.
Luke Wagner and Tanner Johnson, thanks for joining us.
No, thank you guys for having us here. It's a real pleasure.
And just remind me the title of your upcoming album.
So there actually isn't a working title yet. Right now we have this collection of songs. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to be a real grabber. I was contemplating the idea of Heroes, Heartbreaks, and Crooks because they're kind of encompasses all of those things and likes to... It goes back and forth. We might use a track from the album instead, maybe Run With Me, which seems to be kind of the leader of the pack of that songs there. So, we'll see how it all turns out. So it's still kind of early. We just got done doing all the scratch recordings for it, and we're still working on it. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How would you describe your sound? Is it it's a little bluegrass, it's a little country?
Yeah, it's got a lot of different mixtures. And you know, the guys I play with, the 441s, who Tanner was kind enough to join us here with us today, and they all add these different really incredible elements to the music. I've always been very heavily based in singer songwriter, and mm-hmm. for the storytelling and folk music as well. But I knew that for the sound that we wanted to create, I wanted to make it enjoyable for listeners. Because not everybody is into, real sappy singer-songwriter stuff or, mm-hmm. Old-timey folk music and bluegrass. And so I used that to you know, kind of like find the musicians. And so now it's kind of more of this alt-country kind of feel. Some people call it Americana. If you're out west, they call it red dirt music. You know, so it's kind of got those different vibes, very heavily based in 70s influences. You can easily tell that from the get-go. So,
and is that because you grew up listening to that stuff?
Oh, absolutely. Jackson Browne was one of my heroes, and when I was 12 years old, my parents took me to see the Eagles in concert, and that was a life-changing experience, you know, and I think for the next... probably like 9 months, I think. I just listened to nothing but Eagles records, and it was probably the best time of my life. And I still, you know, I still have those, you know, many of those albums in circulation at my, you know, home system there, and just going through them all the time and studying and listening and, you know, taking all I can from it. So
you're not afraid of busting out some covers too, right?
No, actually, I think that's one of our, the most fun that we have is when we are entertaining the audience. We do a small trio act around town where it's me, Tanner, and our drummer and percussionist, David Altman. And we do all sorts of stuff. And we get weird requests and things we've never played before, but we'll take a shot at it. You know, we want to make sure. Tanner once told me back when we had first started out, you know, he said, you know, we're in a service industry. And I've always kind of kept that mentality. And, we, you know, we're serving the audience and we need to make sure that they're having a good time. They're joining us for their evening, so we need to make sure they're having a great time. So
everything from Tom Petty to Beyonce.
Oh yeah.
how do you do the sort of violin licks on a Beyonce song? How does that work?
Man, you just got to get inspired by those dance moves. No, it's all the same. You know, you just find the key and just play. So,
what do you listen to, Tana?
Oh man, I listen to a lot of the musicians that I play with here in town. And I'm a lover of all sorts of things. I grew up playing classical music, love to listen to that. Got really into jazz, went to a jazz school, and listened to a lot of singer-songwriters, a lot of bluegrass. Yeah, I listen to Luke Wagner.
So, Luke, tell me a little bit about the next song you guys are going to play.
Yeah, this is, like I said, this is kind of the leader of the pack kind of song for our upcoming album. It's called Run With Me. It was, you know, kind of written at a time where, you know, I was trying to find myself. And, you know, it just so happened that I had met this really incredible girl. And we kind of just blended together really well. I've never met anyone like her who I've been able to be myself with and, you know, mesh so well together. And, so it kind of started the song, and but it's really just about, you know, having those plans with somebody where, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of situation that we get in, and, you know, we're always going to have a great adventure together, you know, because it's us. So
all right, yeah. Run With Me, take it away.
Found out who you were. Just a tramp howling at the moon, and you're living on the edge of the absurd. Now you say you don't remember the girl you used to be, when everybody's made up their own mind. And if you're looking for your freedom, honey, I'm the guy to see. Your little hand inside of mine. Honey, you can run with me. Run with me. Run with me. tramp howling at the moon, waiting for a lady just to pull him through. Cause Tulsa nights where they keep us going on, ringing out to the break of dawn. And we boo and chase tornadoes, then we walk out on the wing. You and I are underneath the spell. It's a long road to heaven, just a shorter trip to hell. But you know it's just a little too soon to tell. Gonna get run with me. Run with me. Run with me.
Wagner and Tanner Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having us. We're excited to be here.
And where can Orlando audiences and Central Florida audiences hear you perform next?
Our next full band show is going to be over at Will's Pub on July 22nd for the Great Orlando Americana Fest.
Well, good luck recording and producing the album and
financing the album. You know? That's where you need to really say your prayers for me, you know?
That's always a challenge, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And when's the album due out?
We're shooting for January of 2019, so that'll be great. It'll be kind of my birthday present to myself then, so that'll be a good time.
Thank you so much for performing. Such
thank
a pleasure
much.
To have you guys in the studio.
Thank you very much.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Brenda Argetta. Find us on the NPR One app. Download the podcast from iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter @Matthew_Petty. And thanks for listening.